Section 8. Concerning the supposed liberty of the will as opposite to all necessity. It is chiefly insisted on by Arminians in this controversy as a thing most important and essential in human liberty, that volitions or the acts of the will are contingent events, understanding contingents as opposite, not only to constraint, but to all necessity. Therefore, I would particularly consider this matter. And, first, I would inquire whether there is or can be any such thing as a volition which is contingent in such a sense, as not only to come to pass without any necessity of constraint or coaction, but also without a necessity of consequence, or an infallible connection with anything foregoing. Secondly, whether, if it were so, this would at all help the cause of liberty. Roman numeral 1. I would consider whether volition is a thing that ever does or can come to pass in this manner contingently. And here it must be remembered that it is already shown that nothing can ever come to pass without a cause or a reason, why it exists in this manner rather than another. And the evidence of this has been particularly applied to the acts of the will. Now, if this be so, it will demonstrably follow that the acts of the will are never contingent or without necessity, in the sense spoken of, inasmuch as those things which have a cause or a reason of their existence must be connected with their cause. And this appears by the following considerations. Number one, for an event to have a cause and ground of its existence, and yet not to be connected with its cause, is an inconsistence. For if the event be not connected with the cause, it is not dependent on the cause. Its existence is, as it were, loose from its influence, and may attend it, or may not, it being a mere contingence, whether it follows or attends the influence of the cause or not. And that is the same thing as not to be dependent on it. And to say the event is not dependent on its cause is absurd. It is the same thing as to say it is not its cause, nor the event the effect of it. For dependence on the influence of a cause is the very notion of an effect. If there be no such relation between one thing and another, consisting in the connection and dependence of one thing as the influence of another, then it is certain there is no such relation between them as is signified by the terms cause and effect. So far as an event is dependent on a cause and connected with it, so much causality is there in the case, and no more. The cause does or brings to pass no more in any event than is dependent on it. If we say the connection and dependence is not total but partial, and that the effect, though it has some connection and dependence, yet is not entirely dependent on it, that is the same thing as to say that not all that is in the event is an effect of that cause, but that only part of it arises from thence, and part some other way. Number two, if there are some events which are not necessarily connected with their causes, then it will follow that there are some things which come only to pass without any cause, contrary to the supposition. For if there be any event which was not necessarily connected with the influence of the cause under such circumstances, then it was contingent whether it would attend or follow the influence of the cause or no. It might have followed, and it might not, when the cause was the same, its influence the same, and under the same circumstances. And if so, why did it follow rather than not follow? Of this, there is no cause or reason. Therefore, Here is something without any cause or reason why it is. Meaning, the following of the effect on the influence of the cause with which it was not necessarily connected. If there be no necessary connection of the effect on anything antecedent, then we may suppose that sometimes the event will follow the cause, and sometimes not, when the cause is the same and in every respect in the same state and circumstances. And what can be the cause and reason of this strange phenomenon, even this diversity, that in one instance the effect should follow in another not? It is evident by the supposition that this is wholly without any cause or ground. Here is something in the present manner of the existence of things and the state of the world that is absolutely without a cause, which is contrary to the supposition and contrary to what has been before demonstrated. Number 3. To suppose there are some events which have a cause and ground of their existence that yet are not necessarily connected with their cause is to suppose that they have a cause which is not their cause. Thus, if the effect be not necessarily connected with the cause, with its influence, and influential circumstances, then, as I observed before, it is a thing possible and supposable that the cause may sometimes exert the same influence under the same circumstances, and yet the effect not follow. And if this actually happens in any instance, this instance is a proof, in fact, that the influence of the cause is not sufficient to produce the effect. For if it had been sufficient, it would have done it. And yet, by the supposition, in another instance, the same cause, with perfectly the same influence, and when all circumstances which have any influence are the same, it was followed with the effect. By which it is manifest that the effect in this last instance was not owing to the influence of the cause, but must come to pass some other way. For it was proved before that the influence of the cause was not sufficient to produce the effect. And if it was not sufficient to produce it, then the production of it could not be owing to that influence, but must be owing to something else, or owing to nothing. And if the effect be not owing to the influence of the cause, then it is not the cause. Which brings us to the contradiction of a cause and no cause, that which is the ground and reason of the existence of a thing, and at the same time is not the ground and reason of its existence. If the matter be not already so plain as to render any further reasoning upon it impertinent, I would say that which seems to be the cause in the supported case can be no cause, its power and influence having, on a full trial, proved insufficient to produce such an effect. And if it be not sufficient to produce it, then it does not produce it. To say otherwise is to say there is a power to do that which there is not power to do. If there be in a cause sufficient power exerted, and in circumstances sufficient to produce an effect, and so the effect be actually produced at one time, all these things concurring will produce the effect at all times. And so we may turn it the other way, that which proves not sufficient at one time cannot be sufficient at another, with precisely the same influential circumstances. And therefore, if the effect follows, it is not owing to that cause, unless the different time be a circumstance which has influence, but that is contrary to the supposition. For it is supposed that all circumstances that have influence are the same. And besides, this would be to suppose the time to be the cause, which is contrary to the supposition of the other thing being the cause. But if merely diversity of time has no influence, then it is evident that it is as much of an absurdity to say the cause was sufficient to produce the effect at one time and not at another, as to say that it is sufficient to produce the effect at a certain time, and yet not sufficient to produce the same effect at the same time. On the whole, it is clearly manifest that every effect has a necessary connection with its cause, or with that which is the true ground and reason of its existence. And therefore, if it be not evident without a cause, as was proved before, then no event whatsoever is contingent in the manner that Arminians suppose the free acts of the will to be contingent. Section 9. Of the connection of the acts of the will with the dictates of the understanding. It is manifest that no acts of the will are contingent, in such a sense as to be without all necessity, or so as not to be necessary with a necessity of consequence and connection, because every act of the will is some way connected with the understanding, and is as the greatest apparent good is, in the manner which has already been explained, namely, that the soul always wills or chooses that which, in the present view of the mind, considered in the whole of that view, and all that belongs to it, appears most agreeable. Because, as was observed before, nothing is more evident than that, when men act voluntarily, and do what they please, then they do what appears most agreeable to them. To say otherwise would be as much as to affirm that men do not choose what appears to suit them best, or what seems most pleasing to them, or that they do not choose what they prefer, which brings the matter to a contradiction. And, as it is very evident in itself, that the acts of the will have some connection with the dictates or views of the understanding. So this is allowed by some of the chiefs of the Arminian writers, particularly by Dr. Whitby and Dr. Samuel Clark, Dr. Turnbull, though a great enemy to the doctrines of necessity, allows the same thing. In his Christian Philosophy, page 196, he, with much approbation, cites another philosopher as of the same mind in these words. No man, says an excellent philosopher, sets himself above or about anything, but upon some view or other, which serves him for a reason for what he does, and whatsoever faculties he employs. The understanding, with such light as it has, well or ill formed, constantly leads, and by that light, true or false, all her operative powers are directed. The will itself, how absolute and incontrollable soever it may be thought, never fails in its obedience to the dictates of the understanding. Temples have their sacred images, and we see what influence they have always had over a great part of mankind. But in truth, the ideas and images in men's minds are the invisible powers that constantly govern them, and to these they all pay universally a ready submission. But whether this be in a just consistence with themselves and their own notions of liberty, I desire may now be impartially considered. Dr. Whitby plainly supposes that the acts and determinations of the will always follow the understanding's view of the greatest good to be obtained, or evil to be avoided, or, in other words, that the determination of the will constantly and infallibly follow these two things in the understanding. Number one, the degree of good to be obtained and evil to be avoided proposed to the understanding and apprehended, viewed, and taken notice of by it. Number two, the degree of the understanding's apprehension of that good or evil, which is increased by attention and consideration. That this is an opinion in which he is exceeding peremptory, as he is in every opinion which he maintains in his controversy with the Calvinists, with disdain of the contrary opinion as absurd and self-contradictory, will appear by the following words, in his discourse on the five points. Quote, "Now it is certain that what naturally makes the understanding to perceive is evidence proposed and apprehended, considered, or adverted to, for nothing else can be requisite to make us come to the knowledge of the truth. Again, what makes the will choose is something approved by the understanding, and consequently appearing to the soul as good. And whatsoever it refuseth is something represented by the understanding, and so appearing to the will as evil. Whence, all that God requires of us is and can be only this, to refuse the evil and choose the good. Wherefore, to say that evidence proposed, apprehended, and considered is not sufficient to make the understanding approve, or that the greatest good proposed, the greatest evil threatened, when equally believed and reflected on, is not sufficient to engage the will to choose the good and refuse the evil, is in effect to say that which alone doth move the will to choose or to refuse is not sufficient to engage it so to do, which, being contradictory to itself, must of necessity be false. Be it then so, that we naturally have an aversion to the truths proposed to us in the gospel, that only can make us indisposed to attend to them, but cannot hinder our conviction when we do apprehend them and attend to them. Be it that there is in us also a renitency to the good we are to choose, that only can indispose us to believe it is, and to approve it as our chiefest good. Be it that we are prone to the evil that we should decline, that only can render it the more difficult for us to believe it is the worst of evils. But yet, what we do really believe to be our chiefest good will still be chosen, and what we apprehend to be the worst of evils will, whilst we do continue under that conviction, be refused by us. It therefore can only be requisite, in order to these ends, that the good spirit should so illuminate our understandings that we, attending to and considering what lies before us, should apprehend and be convinced of our duty, and that the blessings of the gospel should be so propounded to us as that we may discern them to be our chiefest good, and the miseries it threateneth, so as we may be convinced that they are the worst of evils, that we may choose the one and refuse the other." End of quote. Let it here be observed how plainly and peremptorily it is asserted that the greatest good proposed and the greatest evil threatened, when equally believed and reflected on, is sufficient to engage the will to choose the good and refuse the evil, and that is alone which doth move the will to choose or to refuse, and that it is contradictory to itself to suppose otherwise, and therefore must of necessity be false. And then what we do really believe to be our chiefest good will still be chosen, and what we apprehend to be the worst of evils will, whilst we continue under that conviction, be refused by us. Nothing could have been said more to the purpose, fully to signify that the determinations of the will must evermore follow the illumination, conviction, and notice of the understanding with regard to the greatest good and evil proposed, reckoning both to the degree of good and evil understood, and the degree of understanding, notice, and conviction of that proposed good and evil, and that it is thus necessarily, and can be otherwise in no instance, because it is asserted that it implies a contradiction to suppose it ever to be otherwise. I am sensible that the doctor's aim in these assertions is against the Calvinists, to show, in opposition to them, that there is no need of any physical operation of the Spirit of God on the will, to change and determine that to a good choice, but that God's operation and assistance is only moral, suggesting ideas to the understanding, which he supposes to be enough if those ideas are attended to, infallibly, to obtain the end. But whatever his design was, nothing can more directly and more fully prove that every determination of the will in choosing and refusing is necessary, directly contrary to his own notion of the liberty of the will. For if the determination of the will evermore in this manner follows the light, conviction, and view of the understanding concerning the greatest good and evil, and this be that alone which moves the will, and it be a contradiction to suppose otherwise, then it is necessarily so. The will necessarily follows this light or view of the understanding, not only in some of its acts, but in every act of choosing and refusing, so that the will does not determine itself in any one of its own acts, but every act of choice and refusal depends on and is necessarily connected with some antecedent cause, which cause is not the will itself, nor any act of its own, nor anything pertaining to that faculty, but something belonging to another faculty, whose acts go before the will and in all its acts, and govern and determine them. Here it should be replied that although it be true that, according to the doctor, the final determination of the will always depends upon and is infallibly connected with the understanding's conviction and notice of the greatest good, and yet the acts of the will are not necessary, because that conviction of the understanding is first dependent on a preceding act of the will, and determining to take notice of the evidence exhibited, by which means the mind obtains that degree of conviction which is sufficient and effectual to determine the consequent and ultimate choice of the will, and that the will, with regard to that preceding act, whereby it determines whether to attend or no, is not necessary, and that in this the liberty of the will consists, that when God holds forth sufficient objective light, the will is at liberty whether to command the attention of the mind to it or not. Nothing can be more weak and inconsiderate than such a reply as this, for that preceding act of the will, in determining to attend and consider, still is an act of the will. If the liberty of the will consists in it, as is supposed, as if it be an act of the will, it is an act of choice or refusal. And therefore, if what the doctor asserts be true, it is determined by some antecedent light in the understanding concerning the greatest apparent good or evil. For he asserts, it is that light which alone doth move the will to choose or refuse. And therefore the will must be moved by that, in choosing to attend to the objective light offered, in order to another consequent act of choice, so that this act is no less necessary than the other. And if we suppose another act of the will, still preceding both these mentioned, to determine both, still that there also must be an act of the will, or an act of choice, and so must, by the same principles, be infallibly determined by some certain degree of light in the understanding concerning the greatest good. And let us suppose as many acts of the will, one preceding another, as we please, yet are they every one of them necessarily determined by a certain degree of light in the understanding, concerning the greatest and most eligible good in that case. And so, not one of them free, according to Dr. Whitby's notion of freedom. And if it be said, the reason why men do not attend to light held forth, it is because of ill habits, contracted by evil acts committed before, whereby their minds are indisposed to consider the truth held forth to them. The difficulty is not at all avoided. Still, the question returns, What determined the will and those preceding evil acts? It must, by Dr. Whitby's principles, still be the view of the understanding concerning the greatest good and evil. If this view of the understanding be that alone which doth move the will to choose or refuse, as the doctor asserts, then every act of choice or refusal, from a man's first existence, is moved and determined by this view. And this view of the understanding, exciting and governing the act, must be before the act, and therefore the will is necessarily determined in every one of its acts from a man's first existence by a cause beside the will, and a cause that does not proceed from or depend on any act of the will at all, which at once utterly abolishes the doctor's whole scheme of liberty of will. And he, at one stroke, has cut the sinews of all his arguments from the goodness, righteousness, faithfulness, and sincerity of God in his commands, promises, threatenings, calls, invitations, and expostulations, which he makes use of, under the heads of reprobation, election, universal redemption, sufficient and effectual grace, and the freedom of the will of man, and has made vain all his exclamations against the doctrine of the Calvinists, as charging God with manifest unrighteousness, unfaithfulness, hypocrisy, fallaciousness, and cruelty. Dr. Samuel Clarke, in his demonstration of the being and attributes of God, to evade the argument to prove the necessity of volition from its necessary connection with the last dictate of the understanding, supposes the latter not to be diverse from the act of the will itself. But if it be so, it will not alter the case as to the necessity of the act. If the dictate of the understanding be the very same with the determination of the will, as Dr. Clarke supposes, then this determination is no fruit or effect of choice. And if so, no liberty of choice has any hand in it. It is necessary, that is, choice cannot prevent it. If the last dictate of the understanding be the same with the determination of volition itself, then the existence of that determination must be necessary as to volition, inasmuch as volition can have no opportunity to determine whether it shall exist or no, it having existence already before volition has opportunity to determine anything. It is itself the very rise in existence of volition. But a thing after it exists, that has no opportunity to determine as to its own existence. It is too late for that. If liberty consists in that which Arminians suppose, that is, in the will determining its own acts, having free opportunity and being without all necessity, this is the same as to say that liberty consists in the soul having power and opportunity to have what it determinations of the will it pleases. And if the determinations of the will and last dictates of the understanding be the same thing, then liberty consists in the mind having power and opportunity to choose its own dictates of understanding. But this is absurd, for it is to make the determination of choice prior to the dictate of understanding, and the ground of it, which cannot consist with the dictate of the understanding being the determination of choice itself. Here is no alternative but to recur to the old absurdity of one determination before another, and the cause of it, and another before, determining that, and so on in infinitum. If the last dictate of the understanding be the determination of the will itself, and the soul be free with regard to that dictate in the Arminian notion of freedom, then the soul, before that dictate of its understanding exists, voluntarily and according to its own choice determines, in every case, what the dictate of the understanding shall be. otherwise that dictate as to the will is necessary, and the acts determined by it must also be necessary. So that there is a determination of the mind prior to that dictate of the understanding, an act of choice going before it, choosing and determining what that dictate of the understanding shall be, and this preceding act of choice, being a free act of will, must also be the same with another last dictate of the understanding. And if the mind also be free in that dictate of understanding, that must be determined still by another, and so on, forever. Besides, if the dictate of understanding and determination of the will be the same, this confounds the understanding and will, and makes them the same. Whether they be the same or no, I will not now dispute, but only would observe that if it be so, and the Arminian notion of liberty consists in a self-determining power in the understanding, free of all necessity, being independent, undetermined by anything prior to its own acts and determinations, and the more the understanding is thus independent and sovereign over its own determinations, the more free, then the freedom of the soul as a moral agent must consist in the independence of the understanding on any evidence or appearance of things, or anything whatsoever that stands forth to the view of the mind prior to the understanding's determination. And what a liberty is this, consisting in an ability, freedom, and easiness of judging, either according to evidence or against it, having a sovereign command over itself at all times, to judge either agreeably or disagreeably to what is plainly exhibited to its own view. Certainly, it is no liberty that renders persons the proper subject of persuasive reasoning, arguments, expostulations, and such like moral means and inducements, the use of which with mankind is a main argument of the Arminians, to defend their notion of liberty without all necessity. For according to this, the more free men are, the less they are under the government of such means, less subject to the power of evidence and reason, and more independent on their influence and their determinations. And whether the understanding and will are the same or no, as Dr. Clark seems to suppose, yet in order to maintain the Arminian notion of liberty without necessity, the free will is not determined by the understanding, nor necessarily connected with the understanding. And further, from such connection, the greater the freedom. And when the liberty is full and complete, the determinations of the will have no connection at all with the dictates of the understanding. And if so, in vain are all the applications to the understanding, in order to induce any free virtuous act, and so in vain are all instructions, counsels, invitations, expostulations, and all arguments and persuasives whatsoever. For these are but applications to the understanding, and a clear and lively exhibition of the objects of choice to the mind's view. But if, after all, the will must be self-determined and independent on the understanding, to what purpose are things thus represented to the understanding in order to determine the choice? Section 10. Volition necessarily connected with the influence of motives, with particular observations on the great inconsistence of Mr. Chubb's assertions and reasonings about the freedom of the will. That every act of the will has some cause, and consequently, by what has been already proved, has a necessary connection with its cause, and so is necessary by a necessity of connection and consequence, is evident by this, that every act of the will whatsoever is excited by some motive, which is manifest. Because if the mind and willing, after the manner it does, is excited by no motive or inducement, then it has no end which it proposes to itself, or pursues in so doing. It aims at nothing, and seeks nothing. And if it seeks nothing, then it does not go after anything, or exert any inclination or preference towards anything, which brings the matter to a contradiction. Because for the mind to will something, and for it to go after something, by an act of preference and inclination, are the same thing. But if every act of the will is excited by a motive, then that motive is the cause of the act. If the acts of the will are excited by motives, then motives are the causes of their being excited, or, which is the same thing, the cause of their existence. And if so, the existence of the acts of the will is properly the effect of their motives. Motives do nothing as motives or inducements, but by their influence, and so much as is done by their influence is the effect of them. For that is the notion of an effect, something that is brought to pass by the influence of something else. And if volitions are properly the effects of their motives, then they are necessarily connected with their motives. Every effect and event being, as was proved before, necessarily connected with that which is the proper ground and reason of its existence. Thus, it is manifest that volition is necessary and is not from any self-determining power in the will. The volition, which is caused by previous motive and inducement, is not caused by the will exercising a sovereign power over itself to determine, cause, and excite volitions in itself. This is not consistent with the will acting in a state of indifference and equilibrium to determine itself to a preference, for the way in which motives operate is by biasing the will and giving it a certain inclination or preponderation one way. Here it may be proper to observe that Mr. Chubb, in his collection of tracts on various subjects, has advanced a scheme of liberty which is greatly divided against itself and thoroughly subversive of itself, and that many ways. Number one, he is abundant in asserting that the will in all its acts is influenced by motive and excitement, and that this is the previous ground and reason of all its acts, and that it is never otherwise in any instance. He says on page 262, "No action can take place without some motive to excite it." And page 263, "Volition cannot take place without some previous reason or motive to induce it." And page 310, "Action would not take place without some reason or motive to induce it, it being absurd to suppose that the active faculty would be exerted without some previous reason to dispose the mind to action." So also on page 257. And he speaks of these things as what we may be absolutely certain of, and which are the foundation, the only foundation we have of certainly respecting God's moral perfections. That's page 252 to 255, 261 through 264. And yet, at the same time, by his scheme, the influence of motives upon us to excite to action and to be actually a ground of volition is consequent on the volition or choice of the mind. For he greatly insists upon it that in all free actions, before the mind is the subject of those volitions which motives excite, it chooses to be so. It chooses whether it will comply with a motive, which presents itself in view or not, and when various motives are presented, it chooses which it will yield to and which it will reject. That's page 256. Every man has power to act or to refrain from acting agreeably with or contrary to any motive that presents. That's page 257. Every man is at liberty to act or refrain from acting agreeably with or contrary to what each of these motives, considered singly, would excite him to. Man has power and is as much at liberty to reject the motive that does prevail, as he has power and is at liberty to reject those motives that do not. And so, page 310 and 11. In order to constitute a moral agent, it is necessary that he should have power to act or to refrain from acting upon such moral motives as he pleases. And to the like purpose in many other places. According to these things, the will acts first and chooses or refuses to comply with the motive that is presented before it falls under its prevailing influence, and it is first determined by the mind's pleasure or choice what motives it will be induced by before it is induced by them. Excuse me. Now, how can these things hang together? How can the mind first act and by its act of volition and choice determine what motives shall be the ground and reason of its volition and choice? For this supposes the choice is already made before the motive has its effect, and that the volition is already exerted before the motive prevails, so as actually to be the ground of the volition and make the prevailing of the motive the consequence of the volition of which yet it is the ground. If the mind has already chosen to comply with a motive and to yield to its excitement, the excitement comes in too late and is needless afterwards. If the mind has already chosen to yield to a motive which invites to a thing, that implies, and in fact is, a choosing of the thing invited to. And the very act of choice is before the influence of the motive which induces, and is the ground of the choice. The Son is before hand with the Father that begets him. The choice is supposed to be the ground of that influence of the motive, which very influence is supposed to be the ground of the choice, and so vice versa. The choice is supposed to be the consequence of the influence of the motive, which influence of the motive is the consequence of that very choice. And besides, if the will acts first towards the motive before it falls under its influence, and the prevailing of the motive upon it to induce it to act and choose be the fruit and consequence of its act and choice, then how is it the motive a previous ground and reason of the act and choice, so that in the nature of the things, volition cannot take place without some previous reason and motive to induce it, and that this act is consequent upon and follows the motive? Which things Mr. Chubb often asserts as of certain and undoubted truth, so that the very same motive is both previous and consequent, both before and after, both the ground and fruit of the very same thing. Oh, my Lord. Number two, Roman numeral number two. Agreeable to the forementioned inconsistent notion of the will first acting towards the motive, choosing whether it will comply with it in order to it becoming a ground of the will's acting before any act of volition can take place, Mr. Chubb frequently calls motives and excitements to the action of the will the passive ground or reason of that action, which is a remarkable phrase. Then which I presume there is none more unintelligible and void of distinct and consistent meaning than in all the writings of Duns Scotus or Thomas Aquinas. When he represents the motive volition as passive, he must mean passive in that affair, or passive with respect to that action which he speaks of. Otherwise, it is nothing to the design of his argument. He must mean, if that can be called a meaning, that the motive to volition is first acted upon or towards by the volition, choosing to yield to it, making it a ground of action, or determining to fetch its influence from thence, and so to make it a previous ground of its own excitation and existence, which is the same absurdity as if one should say that the soul of man, previous to its existence, chose by what cause it would come into existence, and acted upon its cause to fetch influence thence, to bring it into being, and so its cause was a passive ground of its existence. Mr. Chubb very plainly supposes motive or excitement to be the ground of the being of volition. He speaks of it as the ground or reason of the exertion of an act of the will, page 391 and 392, and expressly says that, quote, volition cannot take place without some previous ground or motive to induce it, end of quote, page 363. And he speaks of the act as from the motive and from the influence of the motive, that's page 352, and from the influence that the motive has on the man for the production of an action, that's page 317. Certainly, there is no need of multiplying words about this. It is easily judged whether motive can be the ground of volition taking place, so that the very production of it is from the influence of the motive, and yet the motive, before it becomes the ground of the volition, is passive, or acted upon the volition. But this I will say, that a man who insists so much on clearness of meaning in others, and is so much in blaming their confusion and inconsistence, ought, if he was able, to have explained his meaning in this phrase of, quote, passive ground of action, end of quote, so as to show it not to be confused and inconsistent. And if any should suppose that Mr. Chubb, when he speaks of motive as a, quote, passive ground of action, end of quote, does not mean passive with regard to that volition which it is the ground of, but some other antecedent volition, though his purpose and argument and whole discourse will by no means allow of such a supposition, yet it would not help the matter in the least. For, number one, if we suppose an act by which the soul chooses to yield to the invitation of a motive to another volition, both these supposed volitions are in effect the very same. A volition to yield to the force of a motive inviting to choose something comes to just the same thing as choosing the thing which the motive invites to, as I observed before. So that here can be no room to help the matter by a distinction of two volitions. Number two, if the motive be passive, not with respect to the same volition to which the motive excites, but to one truly distinct and prior, yet, by Mr. Chubb, that prior volition cannot take place without a motive or excitement as a previous ground of its existence. For he insists that it is absurd to suppose any volition should take place without some previous motive to induce it, so that at last it comes to just the same absurdity. For if every volition must have a previous motive, then the very first in the whole series must be excited by a previous motive. And yet the motive to that first volition is passive, but cannot be passive with regard to another antecedent volition, because, by the supposition, it is the very first. Therefore, if it be passive with respect to any volition, it must be so with regard to that very volition of which it is the ground, and that is excited by it. Roman numeral number 3. Though Mr. Chubb asserts, as above, that every volition has some motive, and that in the nature of the thing, no volition can take place without some motive to induce it, yet he asserts that volition does not always follow the strongest motive, or in other words, is not governed by any superior strength of the motive that is followed, beyond the motives to the contrary, previous to the volition itself. His own words, page 258, are as follow. Quote, though with regard to physical causes, that which is strongest always prevails, yet it is otherwise with regard to moral causes. Of these, sometimes the stronger, sometimes the weaker prevails. And the ground of this difference is evident, namely, what we call moral causes, strictly speaking, are no causes at all, but barely passive reasons or excitements to the action, or to the refraining from acting, which excitements we have power, or are at liberty, to comply with or reject, as I have showed above. End of quote. And so throughout the paragraph, he, in a variety of phrases, insists that the will is not always determined by the strongest motive, unless by strongest we preposterously mean actually prevailing in the event, which is not in the motive but in the will, but that the will is not always determined by the motive, which is strongest, by any strength previous to the volition itself. And elsewhere abundantly asserts that the will is determined by no superior strength or advantage that motives have from any constitution or state of things, or any circumstances whatsoever, previous to the actual determination of the will. And indeed, his whole discourse on human liberty implies it. His whole scheme is founded upon it. But these things cannot stand together. There is a diversity of strength in motives to choice, previous to the choice itself. Mr. Chubb himself supposes that they do previously invite, induce, excite, and dispose the mind to action. This implies that they have something in themselves that is inviting, some tendency to induce and dispose to volition previous to volition itself. And if they have in themselves this nature and tendency, doubtless they have it in certain limited degrees, which are capable of diversity. And some have it in greater degrees, others in less. And they that have most of this tendency, considered with all their nature and circumstances, previous to volition, are the strongest motives. And those that have least are the weakest motives. Now, if volition sometimes does not follow the motive which is strongest, or has most previous tendency or advantage, all things considered, to induce or excite it, but follows the weakest, or that which, as it stands previously in the mind's view, has least tendency to induce it, herein the will apparently acts wholly without motive, without any previous reason to dispose the mind to it, contrary to what the same author supposes. The act, wherein the will must proceed without a previous motive to induce it, is the act of preferring the weakest motive. How absurd is it to say, the mind sees previous reason in the motive to prefer that motive before the other, and at the same time to suppose that there is nothing in the motive, in its nature, state, or any circumstance of it whatsoever, as it stands in the previous view of the mind, that gives it any preference. But on the contrary, the other motive that stands in competition with it in all these respects has most belonging to it that is inviting and moving, and has most of a tendency to choice and preference. This is certainly as much as to say there is previous ground and reason in the motive for the act of preference, and yet no previous reason for it. By the supposition as to all that is in the two rival motives, which tends to preference, previous to the act of preference, it is not in that which is preferred, but wholly in the other. And yet Mr. Chubb supposes that the act of preference is from previous ground and reason in the motive which is preferred. But are these things consistent? Can there be previous ground in a thing for an event that takes place and yet no previous tendency in it to that event? If one thing follows another without any previous tendency to its following, then I should think it very plain that it follows it without any manner of previous reason why it should follow. Yea, in this case, Mr. Chubb supposes that the event follows an antecedent as the ground of its existence, which has not only no tendency to it, but a contrary tendency. The event is the preference, which the mind gives to that motive, which is weaker, as it stands in the previous view of the mind. The immediate antecedent is the view the mind has of the two rival motives conjunctly, in which previous view of the mind, all the preferableness or previous tendency to preference is supposed to be on the other side, or in the contrary motive, and all the unworthiness of preference, and so previous tendency to comparative neglect, or undervaluing, is on that side which is preferred. And yet, in this view of the mind, is supposed to be the previous ground or reason of this act of preference, exciting it, and disposing the mind to it, which I leave the reader to judge, whether it be absurd or not. If it be not, then it is not absurd to say that the previous tendency of an antecedent to a consequent is the ground and reason why that consequent does not follow, and the want of a previous tendency to an event, yea, a tendency to the contrary, is the true ground and reason why that event does follow. An act of choice or preference is a comparative act, wherein the mind acts with reference to two or more things that are compared and stand in competition in the mind's view. If the mind, in this comparative act, prefers that which appears inferior in the comparison, then the mind herein acts absolutely without motive or inducement or any temptation whatsoever. Then, if a hungry man has the offer of two sorts of food, to both which he finds an appetite, but has a stronger appetite to one than the other, and there be no circumstances or excitements whatsoever in the case to induce him to take either the one or the other, but merely his appetite. If in the choice he makes between them, he chooses that which he has least appetite to, and refuses that to which he has the strongest appetite, this is a choice made absolutely without previous motive, excitement, reason, or temptation, as much as if he were perfectly without all appetite to either, because his volition in this case is a comparative act, following a comparative view of the food which he chooses, in which view his preference has absolutely no previous ground, yea, is against all previous ground and motive. And if there be any principle in man, from whence an act of choice may arise after this manner, from the same principle volition may arise wholly without motive on either side. If the mind in its volition can go beyond motive, then it can go without motive. For when it is beyond the motive, it is out of the reach of the motive, out of the limits of its influence, and so without motive. If so, this demonstrates the independence of volition on motive, and no reason can be given for what Mr. Chubb so often asserts. Even that, in the nature of things, volition cannot take place without a motive to induce it. If the Most High should endow a balance with agency or activity of nature in such a manner that when unequal weights are put into the scales, its agency could enable it to cause that scale to descend, which has the least weight, and so to raise the greater weight, this would clearly demonstrate that the motion of the balance does not depend on weights in the scales, at least as much as if the balance should move itself, when there is no weight in either scale. And the activity of the balance, which is sufficient to move itself against the greater weight, must certainly be more than sufficient to move it when there is no weight at all. Mr. Chubb supposes that the will cannot stir at all without some motive, and also supposes that if there be a motive to one thing and none to the contrary, volition will infallibly follow that motive. This is virtually to suppose an entire dependence of the will on motives. If it were not wholly dependent on them, it could surely help itself a little without them, or help itself a little against a motive, without help from the strength and weight of a contrary motive. And yet his supposing that the will, when it has before it various opposite motives, can use them as it pleases, and choose its own influence from them, and neglect the strongest, and follow the weakest, supposes it to be wholly independent on motives. It further appears, on Mr. Chubb's hypothesis, that volition must be without any previous ground in any motive. Thus, if it be, as he supposes, that the will is not determined by any previous superior strength of the motive, but determines and chooses its own motive, then, when the rival motives are exactly equal in all respects, it may follow either, and may, in such a case, sometimes follow one and sometimes the other. And if so, this diversity, which appears between the acts of the will, is plainly without previous ground in either of the motives, for all that is previously in the motives is supposed precisely and perfectly the same, without any diversity whatsoever. Now, perfect identity as to all that is previous in the antecedent cannot be the ground and reason of diversity in the consequent. Perfect identity in the ground cannot be a reason why it is not followed with the same consequence. And therefore, the source of this diversity of consequence must be sought for elsewhere. And lastly, it may be observed that however much Mr. Chubb insists that no volition can take place without some motive to induce it, which previously disposes the mind to it, yet as he also insists that the mind, without reference to any superior strength of motives, picks and chooses for its motive to follow, he himself herein plainly supposes that with regard to the mind's preference of one motive before another, it is not the motive that disposes the will, but the will disposes itself to follow the motive. Wow. Roman numeral number 4. Mr. Chubb supposes necessity to be utterly inconsistent with agency, and that to suppose a being to be an agent in that which is necessary is a plain contradiction. Page 311. And throughout his discourses on the subject of liberty, he supposes that necessity cannot consist with agency or freedom, and that to suppose otherwise is to make liberty and necessity, action and passion, the same thing. And so he seems to suppose that there is no action, strictly speaking, but volition, and that, as to the effects of volition in body or mind, in themselves considered, being necessary, they are said to be free. only as they are the effects of an act that is not necessary. And yet, according to him, volition itself is the effect of volition. Yea, every act of free volition, and therefore every act of free volition must, by what has now been observed from him, be necessary. That every act of free volition is itself the effect of volition is abundantly supposed by him. In page 341, he says, quote, "If a man is such a creature as I have proved him to be, that is, if he has in him a power of liberty of doing either good or evil, and either of these is the subject of his own free choice, so that he might, if he had pleased, have chosen and done the contrary." End of quote. Here he supposes all that is good or evil in man is the effect of his choice, and so that his good or evil choice itself is the effect of his pleasure or choice. In these words, quote, "He might, if he had pleased, have chosen the contrary," end of quote. So, in page 356, quote, "Though it be highly reasonable that a man should always choose the greater good, yet he may, if he pleases, choose otherwise," end of quote. Which is the same thing as if he had said he may, if he chooses, choose otherwise. And then he goes on, quote, "That is, he may, if he pleases, choose what is good for himself," end of quote, etc. And again, in the same page, quote, "The will is not confined by the understanding to any particular sort of good, whether greater or less, but it is at liberty to choose what kind of good it pleases," end of quote. If there be any meaning in the last words, it must be this, that the will is at liberty to choose what kind of good it chooses to choose. Supposing the act of choice itself determined by an antecedent choice. The liberty Mr. Chubb speaks of is not only a man's power to move his body, agreeable to an antecedent act of choice, but to use or exert the faculties of his soul. Thus, page 379, speaking of the faculties of the mind, he says, quote, "Man has power and is at liberty to neglect these faculties, to use them aright, or to abuse them as he pleases," end of quote. And that he supposes an act of choice or exercise of pleasure properly distinct from and antecedent to those acts thus chosen, directing, commanding, and producing the chosen acts, and even the acts of choice themselves, is very plain in page 283. Quote, "He can command his actions, and herein consists his liberty. He can give or deny himself that pleasure as he pleases." And page 377, "If the actions of men are not the produce of a free choice or election, but spring from a necessity of nature, he cannot in reason be the object of reward or punishment on their account. Whereas, if action in man, whether good or evil, is the produce of will or free choice, so that a man has, in either case, had it in his power and was at liberty to have chosen the contrary, he is the proper object of reward or punishment, according as he chooses to behave himself." End of quote. Whoa. Here, in these last words, he speaks of liberty of choosing according as he chooses, so that the behavior of which he speaks of as subject to his choice is his choosing itself, as well as his external conduct consequent upon it. And therefore, it is evident, he means not only external actions, but the acts of choice themselves, when he speaks of all free actions as the produce of free choice. And this is abundantly evident in what he says elsewhere, page 372 and 373. Now, These things imply a twofold great inconsistency. Number one, to suppose, as Mr. Chubb plainly does, that every free act of choice is commanded by and is the produce of free choice is to suppose the first free act of choice belonging to the case, yea, the first free act of choice that ever man exerted, to be the produce of an antecedent act of choice. But I hope I need not labor at all to convince my readers that it is an absurdity to say the very first act is the produce of another act that went before it. Number two, if it were both possible and real, as Mr. Chubb insists, that every free act of choice were the produce or the effect of a free act of choice, yet even then, according to his principles, no one act of choice would be free, but every one necessary, because every act of choice being the effect of a foregoing act, every act would be necessarily connected with that foregoing cause. For Mr. Chubb himself says on page 389, quote, "When the self-moving power is exerted, it becomes the necessary cause of its effects," end of quote. So that his notion of a free act that is rewardable or punishable is a heap of contradictions. It is a free act, and yet, by his own notion of freedom, is necessary, and therefore by him it is a contradiction to suppose it to be free. According to him, every free act is the produce of a free act, so that there must be an infinite number of free acts in succession, without any beginning, and an agent that has a beginning. And therefore, here is an infinite number of free acts, every one of them free, and yet not any one of them free, but every act in the whole infinite chain a necessary effect. All the acts are rewardable or punishable, and yet the agent cannot, in reason, be the object of reward or punishment on account of any one of these actions. He is active in them all and passive in none, yet active in none but passive in all, etc. Number five. Mr. Chubb most strenuously denies that motives are causes of the acts of the will, or that the moving principle in man is moved or caused to be exerted by motives. His words, page 388 and 389, are, quote, "If the moving principle in man is moved or caused to be exerted by something external to man, which all motives are, then it would not be a self-moving principle, seeing it would be moved by a principle external to itself. And to say that a self-moving principle is moved or caused to be exerted by a cause external to itself is absurd and a contradiction," end of quote, etc. And in the next page, it is particularly and largely insisted that motives are causes in no case, that they are merely passive in the production of action and have no causality in the production of it. No causality to be the cause of the exertion of the will? Now I desire it may be considered how this can possibly consist with what he says in other places. Let it be noted here. Number one, Mr. Chubb abundantly speaks of motives as excitements of the acts of the will, and says that motives do excite volition and induce it, and that they are necessary to this end, that in the reason and nature of things, volition cannot take place without motives to excite it. But now, if motives excite the will, they move it. And yet he says it is absurd to say the will is moved by motives. And again, if language is of any significancy at all, if motives excite volition, then they are the cause of its being excited. And to cause volition to be excited is to cause it to be put forth or exerted. Yea, Mr. Chubb says himself on page 317 that motive is necessary to the exertion of the active faculty. To excite is positively to do something, and certainly that which does something is the cause of the thing done by it. To create is to cause to be created. To make is to cause to be made. To kill is to cause to be killed. To quicken is to cause to be quickened. And to excite is to cause to be excited. To excite is to be a cause in the most proper sense, not merely a negative occasion, but a ground of existence by positive influence. The notion of exciting is exerting influence to cause the effect to arise or come forth into existence. Number two, Mr. Chubb himself on page 317 speaks of motives as the ground and reason of action by influence and by prevailing influence. Now, what can be meant by a cause but something that is the ground and reason of a thing by its influence, an influence that is prevalent and effectual? Number three, this author not only speaks of motives as the ground and reason of action by prevailing influence, but expressly of their influence as prevailing for the production of an action. That's page 317. Which makes the inconsistency still more palpable and notorious. The production of an effect is certainly the causing of an effect, and productive influence is causal influence, if anything is. And that which has this influence prevalently, so as thereby to become the ground of another thing, is a cause of that thing, if there be anything or any such thing as a cause. This influence, Mr. Chubb says, motives have to produce an action, and yet he says it is absurd and a contradiction to say that they are causes. Number four, in the same page, he once and again speaks of motives as disposing the agent to action by their influence. His words are these, quote, as motive, which takes place in the understanding and is the product of intelligence, is necessary to action, that is, to the exertion of the active faculty, because that faculty would not be exerted without some previous reason to dispose the mind to action. So from hence it plainly appears that when a man is said to be disposed to one action rather than another, this properly signifies the prevailing influence that one motive has upon a man for the production of an action, or for the being at rest before all other motives, for the production of the contrary. For as motive is the ground and reason of any action, so the motive that prevails disposes the agent to the performance of that action. End of quote. Now, if motives dispose the mind to action, then they cause the mind to be disposed. And to cause the mind to be disposed is to cause it to be willing. And to cause it to be willing is to cause it to will. And that is the same thing as to be the cause of an act of the will. And yet this same Mr. Chubb holds to it to be absurd to suppose motive to be the cause of the act of the will. And if we compare these things together, we have here again a whole heap of inconsistencies. Motives are the previous ground and reason of the acts of the will, yea, the necessary ground and reason of their exertion, without which they will not be exerted and cannot, in the nature of things, take place. And they do excite these acts of the will, and do this by a prevailing influence, yea, an influence which prevails for the production of the act of the will and for the disposing of the mind to it. And yet it is absurd to suppose motive to be a cause of an act of the will, or that a principle of the will is moved or caused to be exerted by it, or that it has any causality in the production of it, or any causality to be the cause of the exertion of the will. A due consideration of these things which Mr. Chubb has advanced, the strange inconsistencies which his notion of liberty, consisting in the will's power of self-determination, void of all necessity, united with that dictate of common sense, there can be no volition without a motive, drove him into, may be sufficient to convince us, that it is utterly impossible ever to make that notion of liberty consistent with the influence of motives and volition. And as it is in a manner self-evident that there can be no act of will or preference of the mind without some motive or inducement, something in the mind's view which it aims at and goes after, so it is most manifest that there is no such liberty in the universe as Arminians insist on, nor any such thing possible or conceivable.